Good morning, and I'm happy to be here and impressed that so many people are out here this early in the morning to hear about something as perhaps as complex and scary as health reform. But, you know, the world is always changing, and I think health reform really does offer for us some incredible opportunities to rethink how we do public health. And in fact, I'm starting with some assumptions in giving this talk. The first is that we are in a period of transformation. Health reform is going to require a new way of doing business for all of public health, including STD programs. And so we either change or we will be changed. And usually we want to control the terms of the change, so we need to get on board. Change is good. Not all change is good, but we need change in STDs because we have too much business as things stand now, and so we can't claim that the system that we have in place is working so perfectly that it doesn't need to change. And so we need to see some of the opportunities that are associated with health reform. The third assumption that I also think is important is, regardless of the outcome of the politics, regardless of the election, regardless of what the Supreme Court is saying or ultimately says, we are going through a transformation of our healthcare system. The quality movement preceded the Affordable Care Act. The investment in health information technology preceded and is separate from and will continue regardless of the outcome of the debate around the Affordable Care Act. Key elements of the Affordable Care Act are already in place, and they're not going to change because the politics won't permit it. And the key elements that take effect in 2014 are likely to be kept regardless of the outcome of the debate around the individual mandates. So what I'm going to try to review for you in a very short period of time is sort of the new vision that that health reform offers us in general and how it affects public health, and then particularly looking at some of the changes this means for STDs. Certainly, there's a new vision for coverage. Coverage doesn't always mean access, but it does lead to access. And that means, and that's in turn, that really means getting very close to universal coverage. And we'll hear from Massachusetts what that really means. And we now have more and more data showing that that increase in coverage really does make a difference in terms of health outcomes. There's certainly an expanded vision for quality. We're restructuring our delivery systems to improve quality and to become more cost effective. There is now more performance measurement, so we're going to be expected to make a difference in people's health, not just deliver a lot of services. Electronic health records provide a huge opportunity for us to integrate prevention and learn more about the people who are getting sick. And the new investments in comparative effectiveness research mean we're going to have to see whether we're actually going to learn whether the methods and approaches that we undertake now or that we may change in the context of health reform really are better. There's also a fundamental change in how we think about prevention, bringing it much more into the community and thinking much more in terms of the social determinants of health. And we need to be thinking about all of this in the context of tight resources as budgets get tighter and tighter. So most of you probably know this, but it's worth restating. The Affordable Care Act means a vast expansion of coverage. For many of the people that we think about in STD clinics, and as you know, I come from HIV, this first bullet is what we've been fighting for 30 years, which is that people who are, you know, under the current system, everyone assumes that if you are poor, you're eligible for Medicaid. It is not strictly a poverty program. You have to be poor and something else, poor and disabled, poor and pregnant, poor and a child, poor and elderly. Now, starting in 2014, if you are at 133% of the federal poverty level or lower, you will indeed be eligible for Medicaid. That eliminates the catch-22 for people with HIV who had to wait till they were disabled to get Medicaid and have the coverage that would have prevented them from getting disabled in the first place. It means that anyone who comes to an STD clinic who is below 133% of poverty now should be insured. Similarly, there is guaranteed issue of private health insurance and a mandate to have it beginning in 2014, and there are subsidies for purchasing that insurance up to 400% of poverty, and that covers both premiums and cost sharing. Underwriting is limited to age, geography, and smoking history. So again, much broader access to insurance. And between now and 2014, there is actually a pre-existing condition insurance plan that's a bridge to 2014 for people who have not been able to buy insurance on the individual market. We have some additional protections, no rescissions, no pre-existing exclusion for kids, no lifetime caps, a regulation on annual caps, all in place today, including extending coverage for kids up to 26. Starting in 2014, no pre-existing condition exclusions for adults, and coverage of routine costs associated with participation in clinical trials. So a major change in how insurance is delivered. I mentioned the Medicaid expansion and how important that is. Something to keep an eye on is that the expansion population does not have to get traditional Medicaid benefits. They can get a benchmark or benchmark equivalent coverage that may more closely resemble what is offered in the private marketplace. That's not always as good as traditional Medicaid, and that's a decision that states are going to be making, and that's going to be important to watch. Who is in those networks? More than likely, these folks are going to be in Medicaid managed care. How those networks are constructed is going to be very important to watch. But what's also interesting is that for the beginning period of the Medicaid expansion, Medicaid primary care services are going to be reimbursed at the Medicare rate with additional federal subsidies. That's a big change. You know, in the world of Medicare, you know, the AMA worries that Medicare rates are too low. In the world of Medicaid, people are thrilled to be getting Medicare reimbursement rates. The mechanism for providing private insurance for those who are individuals or are in small groups will be through these health insurance exchanges, which is essentially, you know, Expedia for health insurance, states are mandated to create these exchanges that will regulate what kind of benefits people are getting, what kind of networks are put in place, how the marketplace will work in their state. A state that opts not to develop the exchange will have one created for them by the federal government. All the insurance plans sold on the exchanges have to offer an essential health benefits package. This is a list of them. What's important here is clearly traditional prescription drugs, ambulatory patient care services, and preventive and wellness services, all critical when you think about STDs. But what does that mean in terms of coverage of preventive services? All health plans are required to provide evidence-based items or services that are rated A or B by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, all ACIP-recommended immunizations, as well as other standards for kids and adolescents that have been developed by HRSA, and additional screenings and preventive care recommended by HRSA. And this is actually, it'll be updated by HRSA, but it was initially an IOM report. That sounds really good, and it's with no cost sharing, first dollar coverage. However, U.S. Preventive Services Task Force guidelines don't always match what the CDC has recommended. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force is very focused on individual decision-making by a clinician and does not think in terms of a population health perspective. These guidelines were never developed with coverage in mind, and therefore we have this discordance. So this is a link to what they say about sexually transmitted infections. There are few A's or B's for sexually transmitted screening unless people are defined as at risk. There's a similar discordance between what the CDC says and what U.S. Preventive Services Task Force says on hepatitis. Similarly, on HIV testing, what you can see here as well is while they support screening for people who are at increased risk. They make no recommendation, so therefore it is a C. It's not an A or B, therefore it is not covered automatically. No recommendation for or against routinely screening for HIV adolescents and adults who are not at increased risk for HIV infection. So that makes it, and their definition of increased risk is someone who has one or more individual risk factors or receives health care in a high prevalence or high risk clinical setting. That's a narrower definition, unless we're clever and creative in how we use it, than perhaps the CDC might recommend. Now, ironically, the Institute of Medicine did make recommendations on women's preventive health services. So this now guarantees automatic first dollar coverage for regular HPV screening for women, annual counseling for STIs, no issue of for people at increased risk, and annual HIV counseling and screening. So in this deal, women get a better deal than men do in terms of preventive screening. Coverage alone does not guarantee access, so there are investments in the Affordable Care Act to expand the safety net, $11 billion over 5 years to expand the Community Health Center program, an initial investment in expanding the healthcare workforce, and as I mentioned, improved reimbursement rates for Medicaid providers. All of that, one hopes, will increase both the workforce and the level of access. There's also a tremendous interest in prevention and a much broader view of what prevention means. One of the major changes is that there is a prevention and public health fund. It is a mandatory funding stream, $12.5 billion over the next 10 years. We won't discuss that it could have been larger if Congress hadn't used some of it to pay for the doc fix. That's a separate issue. But this is the first time public health has ever had a mandatory funding stream, guaranteed to be there regardless of what happens in the appropriations process. That money is automatically available every October 1st. Congress can help decide how it is spent, but if Congress doesn't make those decisions, the administration can go forth and spend it, we hope, effectively. One of the programs funded by the Prevention Fund is the Community Transformation Grants, which has an emphasis on community prevention and policy and systems change. The philosophy here, and that underlies a lot of the investments in prevention in the Affordable Care Act, is that we can't solve our health problems one person at a time or even one small group at a time. We have to start getting at the policies and the systems and the environment that will help make the healthy choice the easy choice, and also over time address some of the social determinants of health. There's also a desire reflected in the community transformation grants, but also in how the prevention fund is being spent to encourage consolidation of funding lines, to get away from the strict categorization that we tend to have, and to think about meeting people where they are, and understanding that people have multiple risks, and if we're not addressing them coherently and together, we're really never going to solve the individual problems. So a siloed approach is no longer going to work. And in fact, we need to think much more broadly about who helps and creates, helps to make and create health. And so the Affordable Care Act created a National Prevention Council that is chaired by the Surgeon General, which really is setting this much larger table for health. It's saying it's not just HHS and VA and DOD that deliver a lot of care and do traditional public health, but it's agriculture and education and homeland security and housing and urban development and justice and go on and on, 17 agencies and offices that have a role to play either directly in improving health or in building the foundation from which people can be healthy. And so it's a whole new dialogue. It's saying to schools, yes, we need you to promote physical activity so kids are not just not obese but have reduced sexually transmitted infections, but also that when those kids are physically active, they'll do better in school. That there's a win-win for both sides of this equation, but that all of them have to start thinking about life, about their work with a health perspective or a health in all policies approach. The Council developed a national prevention strategy with the vision of, or goal of increasing the number of Americans who are healthy at every stage of life. and then talks about four strategic directions that really, you know, includes what we might, you know, sort of the traditional public health interventions of clinical and community preventive services, but also thinks about healthy and safe community environments. Some of that may be traditional environmental exposures, but it also means if we don't have safe streets, people are not going to be physically active. It also means that if we don't have safe schools and protect kids from bullying, they're going to be at increased risks for things like HIV and sexually transmitted diseases. There we go. It also means that we need to think about empowering people and creating more resilient individuals and communities, because without that empowerment and without that self-efficacy, people are not going to be able to address any of their problems. And of course, we have to think about all of these issues from the context of health equity and health disparities, because if we don't have a particular focus on those, we're really not going to be able to move forward. So those are the strategic directions that all of these agencies have committed to doing some work around. There are seven priorities, one of which is reproductive and sexual health, and that was a long debate. Is it reproductive health? Is it sexual health? Is it reproductive and sexual health? It went back and forth many times, depending on the politics of the moment. Unfortunately, this got out almost a year ago before the current debate, or there would be no reproductive and sexual health. Yeah, what can I say? So that's the larger picture, and I think it's really, really important. And, you know, it came up last night in Jim Kern's discussion when he was talking about how important the social context is and the community environment is as we're thinking about the history of HIV and now as we think going forward about how we're going to deal with STDs. That larger picture, that sense of bringing more partners to the table, of working collaboratively across agencies, of everyone recognizing that they have a role to play in promoting health, including preventing sexually transmitted infections, is really important. So from a narrower focus of STDs and the changes that are about to happen, there's a lot that's going to be decided at the state level. Even if you're from a state that says we're suing about the Affordable Care Act, they still are going to be making some decisions. So what are the essential benefits that are going to be offered in the exchange? How are sexually transmitted diseases determined? Who are going to be the providers? What's going to be the benefit package for the Medicaid expansion? Will it be the essential benefits in the insurance exchanges, or will it be traditional Medicaid benefits that tend to be more robust? What will the provider networks look like, both on the exchanges and in Medicaid? You know, part of the system reforms that are being taking place are creation of accountable care organizations and medical homes that are responsible not just for individual outcomes, but for population outcomes. Public health has something to offer those accountable care organizations in being able to improve population health. And so creating those relationships, helping them do good, helping them achieve their goal of improving population health and therefore getting some extra money, means creating a relationship that is not just helping them achieve that goal, but perhaps also helping them pay for the work that you do. And we're going to have to maximize coverage under current Medicaid rules. There are lots of opportunities to be much more creative in the Medicaid system for non-traditional services offered by non-traditional providers in non-traditional settings, think community, that affect health, that can make a difference, and that Medicaid under current law can also be supporting. Very quickly, there's some other opportunities. There's the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services now goes around saying we're learning how to be a public health agency. We're here to help them learn how to be a public health agency. There's certainly, they've created a population health group as part of their innovation center that is looking to see how public health and how community and clinical prevention can be better linked and can be better integrated. And so there's some real opportunities there for some real money. The center has $10 billion to spend. So some real opportunities to test and demonstrate and bring to scale some innovative approaches. Health information technology provides a tremendous opportunity. We're now in the second, where the proposed rules for the second stage of meaningful use of health information technology. Those proposed rules are out there. A lot more related to public health, a lot more opportunities for you in your public health agencies to know so much more about who's getting a sexually transmitted disease and what else is going on in their lives if we have the capacity at the public health end to receive and analyze it and if the health information technology is designed appropriately. So What does that mean going forward? It means that we need to think differently about how we do public health and do our public health programs. We need to realign program services and the rationale for public health to accommodate this new approach in a reforming system. We have to be engaging decision makers to make sure that what is being offered in this new system is appropriate and retains a role for public health. And we also need to make sure that within STDs, we're participating in the larger community prevention efforts that address the social determinants of health. So a lot of the attention around community prevention is focused on chronic diseases. Not, yes, I know HIV is sort of a chronic disease now, and some STDs for some people are chronic diseases, but they're thinking obesity, heart disease, those kinds of chronic diseases. But a lot of the interventions that are appropriate at the community level for chronic diseases are also ones that can address some of the determinants of sexually transmitted diseases. And so creating those linkages and de-siloing all of our community prevention efforts is going to be very, very important. So that was a very rapid run through of the many opportunities, and we are deliberately trying to keep this brief so that we're provoking a lot of questions that we can have some robust discussion. Thank you. Well done.